You're listening to a previously recorded Gulf Coast Live. Later this hour, we're going to explore the recently released National Climate Assessment and what it means for Florida and for the health of Floridians. We're joined by a geologist and a medical doctor to learn more. But first, after nearly half a decade of advocating for the civil rights of others, Howard Simon retired last week from his role as executive director of the ACLU of Florida. He held that role for 21 years, and before that, he was the executive director of the ACLU of Michigan for more than two decades. In all, his 44 years as a state director is the longest in the ACLU's 98-year history. Over the decades, Simon has seen a lot of change, and he's been on the front lines of some major civil rights battles, which culminated this year with the ACLU of Florida's backing of Amendment 4, which restores the voting rights for most former felons in Florida. He joins us in studio today to reflect on his career and some of the stories and issues that he's been part of. Howard Simon, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
And as always, we invite you to join our conversation. The number to call is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So how does it feel to step down after all these years?
Well, I'm still cleaning out my office, so I'm not fully feel like I'm retired yet, but Friday was my last day, but I'm still working with staff and I'm still been in the office and so on. But I'm looking forward to the next stage of life.
Yeah. Well, okay. So take me all the way back. How did you first get involved with civil rights?
Wow.
Was that a passion that you had early on?
Well, certainly as a college student, even as a high school student, I think I was involved in that. What I think is kind of ironic and makes this kind of a full circle is that I got swept up into the civil rights movement when I was a college student in the 60s. And I was involved in student government at the college I went to in New York City. And it was in 1965 when we got a telegram from Dr. Martin Luther King asking supporters to come down and help with the efforts and the marches to support the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. And myself and two friends went down and stayed there for some time and worked in the basement of Brown's Chapel in Selma, Alabama, on the mimeograph machine under the direction of King's Lieutenant Dr. Andrew Young. And so it seems like full circle to – so I was involved in voting rights crusades. That was 1965, and here it is now more than 50 years later, and I'm just so pleased to be able to retire after the passage of Amendment 4 that I think will hopefully fundamentally change Florida and make Florida more of a democratic state, democratic in a small d in a sense, and more people will be
not party affiliation, yeah.
Participating in our democracy. So I got involved in civil rights work starting in my college student days.
What a way to begin things. It's pretty inspiring.
Oh, that was close to a life-changing experience. Oh my God, to be in Brown's Chapel in 1965 and to hear Martin Luther King's speech, to march the I think it was about 80 miles along, along. Oh man, was it Highway 80? So maybe it wasn't a full 80 miles.
Yeah, 80 miles would take a while.
Yes, that would take a while. But I figured how many miles it was long. It was Highway 80 to the march and the rally and the speech at the state capitol in Alabama, under the Confederate flag that was flying over the capitol. That was a life-changing experience. And then ironically, this is all kind of a small world ironic story, at least in my life. That was in 1965. If people remember, the Selma to Montgomery March for Voting Rights ended with the brutal murder of a Detroit housewife who came down also as a volunteer, Viola Liuzzo, and she was murdered when a car filled with four Klansmen pulled up alongside and shot and killed her. She was ferrying civil rights workers back to Selma from Montgomery. 10 years later, I'm the ACLU director in Michigan in my office in Detroit, where we uncover evidence of the FBI's conspiracy to disrupt the civil rights movement, including beating up the Freedom Riders in 1961. And the FBI's chief paid informant is one of the four people in the car that pulled up alongside Viola,
wow,
and who may have actually even fired the gun that killed her. I spent the next maybe 10 years of my life working with the family of Viola Liuzzo in lawsuits against the FBI to alleging their responsibility for her murder and for the attack on the Freedom Riders 4 years earlier.
You know, and that happened in the 60s. What did you think here in the last year or so when we had that Unite the Right rally and a person killed by a car, the counter-protesters? I mean, fast forward so many years, I mean, decades, and things,
well,
as much as they change, they kind of stay the same.
Well, yes. I mean, look, the America has always had a horrific right-wing, far-right, and even violent extremist faction. I think what is different is that what we uncovered under the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover is that the government was complicit. Knowingly and actively participating in this. I mean, Hoover had an overriding animosity to Martin Luther King, to the civil rights movement. He thought that these kinds of changes were all kind of a communist conspiracy, and he was actively trying to disrupt it.
Do you feel like sometimes forward progress generally tends, whenever it's when you're moving forward as a civilization, it tends to meet with fierce resistance from the existing power structure?
Well, of course, the more effective you get, the more resistance you get from the power structure. But
you're always wanting to fight. You're the guy that spent your whole career and your whole life fighting on the side, fighting for the justice.
But look, I feel good about all of this because change in America is incremental. And it's always been two steps forward and one step back. And I said that, I mean, I joined the ACLU in the 1960s when I went to graduate school after I graduated college and started teaching college. So 50 years later, we are a lot more equal, a lot freer. I mean, it's maybe two steps forward and one step back, but we are a lot freer and in this country now than we were 50 years ago.
In ways also not just in the area of race. You did a lot of work here in Florida with the LGBTQ movement and
right,
the movement towards marriage equality. And you got Florida kind of ahead of the federal government by 6 months.
Right. And also, I mean, that wasn't the only thing. I mean, we spent, 8 years, 5 different lawsuits to strike down the ban on adoptions by gays and lesbians in Florida. And then we filed the suit on behalf of a bunch of lesbian and gay couples who were married elsewhere or in other countries or in other states where Florida officials refused to recognize their marriage. The lead plaintiff was here from Fort Myers.
Arlene Goldberg,
who had an emotional and inspiring story that I think moved the federal judge in Tallahassee that changed this whole matter. Yeah, I think that to go back to your original question, I think one of the areas where we saw and I think frankly had the greatest effect in Florida was the bringing about much greater equality and equal rights and equal treatment for lesbians and gays in the state of Florida.
But still, to this day, as far as treatment in the workplace is going, municipality by municipality, there's still not a state statute.
Oh, we're not there.
That level,
oh, my God.
Equality.
Yeah, sure. Gays and lesbians have they're not included in federal or state civil rights protections. They can still be fired for being gay or lesbian, maybe except in those few communities in Florida where they're like Miami-Dade, where individual municipalities. You know, sure. Look, the drive for complete human rights is never ending. Yeah. It's always we've made a lot of progress, but there's much more progress that can be made. But just if you go back, I mean, when I started in the ACLU, nobody even dreamed of equal rights for gays and lesbians. They were completely in the closet. Inequality for women was part of the law, certainly part of the custom. Inequality, discrimination against racial minorities was legally required in many parts of the state. We're in many parts of the country. We're a much different country than we were 50 years ago. And I think, I want to say, largely because of the work of our organization.
I think I could probably agree with that. I mean, things have definitely changed and progressed a tremendous amount. And the organization, the ACLU, for people that aren't really that familiar, explain to me what exactly the ACLU does. They advocate, they take a position, but do they physically go to the court and represent?
Oh, well, we're first and foremost, we're a membership organization. We're almost 100 years old. We're the oldest and largest human rights, civil rights, and civil liberties organization in the country. We're completely a citizens organization that oversees what government does and challenge what governments do. And we do it in a lot of different ways. We write laws. We give out information. But people mainly know the ACLU for its legal work. Yes, we represent people and go to court. We represent people and go to court to challenge the policies of government from the local level up to the president of the United States. So I've been involved in hundreds of different lawsuits. I mean, the lawsuit that we mentioned before that Arlene Goldberg was the lead plaintiff in was a lawsuit challenging the ban on the recognition of same-sex marriage here in the state of Florida. So, yes, that is the origin of what the ACLU has done, and still mainly the bread and butter work that we do is provide attorneys and challenge state laws and local ordinances and abuses by government officials.
If you're just joining the show today, I'm talking with Howard Simon, who retired last week after serving for 21 years as the executive director of the ACLU of Florida. But before that, he was with the ACLU in Michigan. If you'd like to ask him a question or add your voice to our discussion, give us a call now at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So as I mentioned, you originally were in Michigan and then moved to Florida. How would you compare and contrast the climate in those two states at the time when you made that move?
Wow, I don't think I was prepared for the fact that how much of a conservative state Florida was coming from the more progressive upper Midwest of Florida. Florida, first of all, Florida is so many different states, you know, West Coast, Midwestern retirees and East Coast retirees. But it is still largely, it certainly was when I came here more than two decades ago, a southern state. I mean, the biggest contrast that I can recall is that I came down to Florida to deal with voting rights and the death penalty. Florida was one of the major Florida, Texas, North Carolina, Georgia, the few remaining places in the world that regularly practiced the death penalty. And I came from Michigan, which was the first jurisdiction in the entire English-speaking world to abolish the death penalty. And I worked a lot on protecting, I mean, the prohibition on the death penalty in Michigan is part of its state constitution. And I worked a lot on protecting that. And then I moved to a state that is one of the main places in the world alongside, you know, places like China and Iran and so on that engages in state executions.
Wow. I mean, quite a different world. And, you know, Florida itself, within itself, as you mentioned, is a different world. I mean, there are just the diversity between coasts and north, south. It seems like the further south you go, the more north you are.
Right.
It's really unusual.
It's many, many, many different states.
It's kind of hard to wrap your hands all the way around it.
And where I live in Miami-Dade County, Miami-Dade County is like, you know, like the capital of Central and South America.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, it's really interesting. And then, of course, you know, I'm going to get into it a little bit later. There are a lot of immigration issues that come up and the 287G. But we do have a call coming in from Brad in Naples who has a question. Brad, what would you like to ask?
How you doing, sir? I'm glad you're on. I'm enjoying this conversation and learning more about the ACLU. I'm like you. I came from up north where there's a lot of workers' protection and consumer protections. And it was kind of shocking when I got to Florida to realize there's a lot of gaps here. And in particular, a couple of years ago, that we did the workman's comp laws here in the state of Florida under the pretense that they needed to save the insurance company money so the small businesses could profit more. What happened is they did cut insurance costs for workman's comp, and the businesses did make more money, but like always, it never transfers to the workers' pocket. In particular, I have a friend that fell in an elevator shaft on a construction site. He's been laid up for 6 months. He hasn't been able to get the surgery that when he first went into the emergency room. They actually put a hospital bed in his home now, and his wife's taking care of him. The workman's comp laws here in this state are absolutely horrible. There's no workers' protection. Is that something HCL can look into?
I'm not sure. I think that's beyond our jurisdiction, frankly. That's a matter. That's why need to be strong labor unions. That's why elections have an impact on the legislature. But we trying to restrict our focus to civil rights and civil liberties that are guaranteed in the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, or maybe state civil rights laws. But employee-employer relations, insurance issues, the extent to which the employer is responsible for the health and welfare of employees. Those are important issues, but they're not necessarily issues that our organization deals with.
Yeah, I think Brad kind of got disconnected there. His phone was a little bit on the weak side as far as a signal. So I hope, Brad, that you got that answer off the phone and over the air. I'm going to shift our focus now. In last month's midterm election, we saw the passage of a Florida constitutional amendment that's going to restore the voting rights of some 1.4 million people who have committed nonviolent felonies but who have repaid their debt to society. This was accomplished through a citizen-led ballot initiative, but we know that the ACLU had been fighting for the restoration of former felons' voting rights for many, many years. Can you tell me a little bit more about the ACLU's role in the evolution of that civil rights battle? You mentioned it a little bit earlier, so it's kind of like that full circle, still working on the voting rights thing so many years later. But how much did the ACLU do in the background before this became something we saw on the ballot?
Well, I'll try not to use up all the rest of your time talking.
It's apparently a little bit of work, huh?
Because our work on this started after the 2000 election, Bush v. Gore, because people remember that election as the world history was changed by the butterfly ballot in Palm Beach County. But it was also changed by the flawed felon purge list that Jeb Bush and his Secretary of State, Catherine Harris, used and were warned not to use, that threw off thousands of people off the voter rolls. The felon purge list was the way in which the state of Florida enforced the system of lifetime felon disfranchisement. So I went to work on that after the 2000 election. We had a project on this. I worked with different governors. I worked with Charlie Crist when Charlie Crist changed the rules of executive clemency that led to the restoration of voting rights for 155,000 people in his four-year term. Those rules of executive clemency were changed dramatically by the current governor, Rick Scott, and it was after he changed the rules of executive clemency that I and other members in the advocacy groups, principally Desmond Mead of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, started talking about how we just can't let voting rights change from governor to governor to governor. We really got to change this completely and have a constitutional amendment, because this has been part of our Constitution for 150 years. So the ACLU was the biggest financial backer of this. And I had a whole team work on this. I was on the committee of three people that wrote the language for Amendment 4 that was approved. I feel proud about this unanimously by the Florida Supreme Court. Florida Supreme Court has to approve the language, and then we got it on the ballot, and we worked hard to get it passed. 65%, almost a little less than that, but almost 65% of the voters. I think this is fascinating. 65% of the voters supported Amendment 4 when the current governor, who is the poster child for the outrageous 150-year-old system of lifetime felon disfranchisement, he won by barely more than 50%. But 65% of the voters essentially repudiated his program and voted to essentially automatically restore the right to vote to people who have completed all the terms of their sentence. I want to say, unlike your introduction, it's not restricted to nonviolent. It's restricted to anybody who has completed all the terms of their sentence, except for people who have committed murder or a felony sex offense. So now we are about to, and people will see the news in the next couple of days, phase two, and that is implementing.
Now that's the challenge. It seems like nobody has a plan.
Because the supervisors of election are meeting in their convention right now in Sarasota, and they are wrestling with state election officials about how to implement it. And I don't think much implementation is necessary. We wrote this language to be self-executing, to cut out the role of politicians. For too long.
Well, we've seen what's happened with medical marijuana, which passed overwhelmingly.
exactly.
You know?
But we wrote this to try to get politicians out of the business of deciding who gets to vote and who doesn't get to vote in Florida. So the constitutional language that the people supported overwhelmingly was that your disqualification from voting ends automatically upon the completion of all the terms of your sentence, and your right shall be restored. I don't think there's anything unclear about that language. State officials just have to get out of the way and respect the wishes of the voters.
It sounds like a computer program thing, you know, and that's about it. I'm going to change the subject now. In this morning's news, we learned about a Key West man who was held on an immigration detainer at the Monroe County Jail, even though he's a U.S. citizen, and he's now suing the Monroe Sheriff Rick Ramsey. I want you to tell me a little bit about the ACLU's efforts under your direction regarding these so-called ICE detainers. This is the 287G thing where various counties have an agreement with federal government, says, OK, we'll go ahead and hold people that you flag, that you want us to hold, that we happen to have placed under arrest because maybe they jaywalked or, you know, whatever, any kind of offense or whatever. They'll keep them even though they're not necessarily charged with a crime or being kept in jail because they're suspected and going through that. They will be kept just because ICE has said we want you to hang on to them for 48 hours. Tell me a little bit more about what ACLU has been trying to do about that.
Well, we have two cases in court right now, one against the Miami-Dade County mayor who has ordered his county jails to hold people just on the request of ICE. These are people who have been charged with a crime, and they get reduced. They get released on bail, or they serve their time. And now, because the federal government has made a request to hold them, not necessarily be for 48 hours, could be, you know, if you take into account over a weekend, it could be as many, could be up to 5 days.
Holidays
and so on. Our point is the following. If you want to hold in America, if you want to hold somebody and deny them their freedom and hold them in jail, you can do that with the authorization of a court. You can't do that on the request of the federal government. And so that's what we are in court right now challenging the Miami-Dade mayor for. We think this is – and courts around the country – have found this practice to be to hold people without authorization by a court, just on the say-so of a government official, to be unconstitutional and illegal and police departments around the and cities around the country have had to pay compensation to people whose constitutional rights have been violated.
Well, it kind of puts a county in a precarious situation as far as getting themselves sued. For example, Monroe County Jail, the guy, Sheriff Rick Ramsey, the one that's being sued right now, that's a county that did something as requested by ICE. Kept a guy, but now they're the ones getting sued. It's not ISIS getting sued.
Oh, that's a good point. That's funny because that the I don't mean to make light of what you said, but I was thinking about at the oral argument in federal court in our case against the Miami-Dade County mayor, the federal judge was asking us, why don't you also name federal officials and sue them for the violation of constitutional rights? Because, you know, they're the ones who requested the county to violate the person's rights. So you might as well sue the federal government as well. So,
but the federal government isn't the one who detained the person.
Exactly. Right. The responsibility of the responsibility of county officials in Monroe County, Miami-Dade County, and anywhere else ought to be something like, fine, you want us to hold this person? Simple. Go to court, get an order from a judge, and we'll hold the person. Absent that, we're going to end up making mistakes like they may holding a U.S. citizen who is suspected to be an undocumented person. That's a mistake for which the county is going to pay for.
And where does that money come from then? I mean, when the county gets
the taxpayers. It's going to come out of the county's budget.
So it'll come out of the county's budget.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's a good thing to make clear for people that live in these countries. I know.
Well,
that
it always happens when, look, you know, if the police, you know, beat up somebody or shoot somebody or something, the public entities have to pay for the violation of people's constitutional rights.
And there's usually a financial settlement that comes right out of these things. I'm wondering how many people are being held on these ICE detainers. Is there any way to know? Because I only hear about a lawsuit here and there. So I would imagine every single person that's kept past what they should be kept or, you know, what is legal to keep them would be filing a lawsuit. But
well, I don't have the number, but I have to say that it's got to be increasing because it's increasing under the pressure of the Trump administration.
Yeah, I'm figuring that this could get expensive too.
Because that's what happened in Miami-Dade County. Miami-Dade County had a policy that they were not going to detain people just on the say-so. And then the president threatened to withhold dollars for Miami-Dade County to build a transportation program. So the mayor decided, well, maybe we'll do what the president wants us to do. So under the threat and from the Trump administration, I wouldn't be surprised if more and more communities are doing that.
Yeah. We have another caller calling in. This is Mark from Naples. Mark, what would you like to ask about?
Yes, I was wanting to ask, Mr. Simon, based on your background in civil rights, have you been involved in some of the work to help victims of the riots or rebellion, as some people would call, that we had in Newark, Detroit, et cetera, in 1967, and some of the reaction in terms of police brutality that were at the root of those riots, and whether that has, you know, have we made much progress today?
Wow, that's a big question. I mean, I wasn't around in Newark. I didn't live in Detroit during the riots in the late 60s, riots or rebellion, however you want to look at it. But dealing with police abuse is an ongoing, continuous problem that we address all the time. I mean, we issue reports. We file lawsuits against police departments. Under the previous national administration, we got police departments to be investigated. I wrote the letter for the mayor in Miami that brought in the U.S. Department of Justice investigating the Miami Police Department for the shooting of a number of unarmed black teenagers that resulted in a change in the administration of the police department and a change in their policies. This is something that we do on a day-to-day basis all the time. So you don't have to go as far back as the riots in Newark and Detroit, but police abuse and is an ongoing civil rights problem in this country. I mean, it's not, you know, I don't want to be trite about it, but the relationship between the racial minority community in this country and largely white police departments is, you know, if you were a black person, if you were a black parent, you would be afraid to what would happen to your teenage child, especially your teenage male child. You'd pray that they come home safely at the end of the day.
As a perspective, I think that a lot of people don't understand unless they are
a person
of color that has a child that's going out into the world.
Right.
And every parent wants to always protect their child, and they worry about him all the time.
Yeah. I mean, just look at the cases that are in court now, the shootings by police officers, the officer-involved shootings that are now, you know, in Chicago, in St. Louis, in Charleston, South Carolina. There are all places around the country where officers are now being charged with the wrongful death of a citizen who they used on whom they used excessive force.
It's interesting. I feel somehow, maybe it's because I'm optimistic, I feel like we've kind of turned a corner, though, where it seems like there's a little bit more of an awareness or an empathy for a parent who worries about their child. So maybe it's being able to strike that chord and have that kind of commonality where people feel like they maybe kind of understand where someone else is coming from a little bit more. And I feel like we're inching – many of us are inching towards that more and more now.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. I tend to think that these are cultural changes. These are political changes. These are changes that have to be demanded of a community through their elections of who's mayor and who's going to be police chief. And I want to say one of the things that has, I think, changed a lot of this is technology. The fact that that an officer's treatment of citizens on the street is now captured because everybody walks around with a camera in their pocket.
Yeah, there's accountability no matter whether
right,
you want it or not.
Exactly. Their accountability.
And that's on all sides too. I mean, there's accountability if someone's misbehaving too. I mean, they can all be caught, everybody.
I mean, one of the things that we have been into, I've certainly been in the middle of doing this in Miami, is to try to increase accountability for police through civilian oversight of police departments. It's not always worked out. It's not worked well in many, many communities. Police departments themselves, police officers, police unions have been resistant to it. But it would be the transparency that comes from a civilian police oversight agency where citizens can file complaints, where complaints can be investigated, where police officers are exonerated more often than they are found to be responsible for abuse, is better for the whole community.
Yeah, I can see how there might be resistance because they don't want to open up a whole other complaint line,
right.
Especially when most of them are exonerated anyway. But the community feeling like it's even being heard is also helpful.
Right.
So I'm going to switch gears again. Last time we had you on the show, it was right after you'd been to Sanibel. You're talking with people about the air and water issues there, which had flared up in 2016. We had you here in 2017. And now this year, they're even worse. When we talked before, we chatted about the right of people on the coast to have clean air and water and whether the state or federal government had knowingly violated those rights by sending blue-green algae-tainted water down the Caloosahatchee and St. Lucie rivers. I'm wondering, since this year, that blue-green algae was even worse, and the federal government decided through the Army Corps of Engineers that water needed to go out the rivers to the coast. What kind of a case could be made that the government was acting unscrupulously?
Well, I want to be very careful here because we're not scientists and
we're
not environmentalists and so on. So the part of this that's relevant to us, to me and to the ACLU was about the government of the state of Florida, through the governor's office especially, not being honest with the people of Florida, holding back information. This is the was the First Amendment right of the people to have access to information that the government. That the governor and the government of Florida was holding back, because all the information about blue-green algae that was coming out of Lake Okeechobee, flowing east to St. Lucie and west here through the Caloosahatchee, it was about dead fish, unsightliness, impact on the tourism industry, impact on the fishing industry. What was not discussed and not told to the people of Florida until maybe more so this year, but certainly we're talking about a couple of years ago when the first big blue-green algae was the health consequences, that there are carcinogenic materials that are in this blue-green algae that are airborne, that you can get exposed to if you go near the water, in the water, certainly eat the fish of the water. There were dramatic health consequences that caused liver cancers. We did work with a number of scientists that documented all of this, and this information was not adequately given to the people of Florida, certainly not the people who live alongside and at the end of the various canals and rivers that come out of Lake Okeechobee. Warning signs needed to be put up, and more needed to be done, not merely to address the tourist industry and the fishing industry, but to protect the health and lives of the people of Florida.
It's interesting that you say that the state didn't give information regarding health, because that was also what we ran into this year in reporting this last summer. I'm sure you heard about it in August. We had a ton of fish early August.
Yeah.
Tons and tons of fish, turtles turning up on the beaches because of red tide, and then also the blue-green algae was happening at the same time. We here at our newsroom tried to contact the State Department of Health numerous times. We could not get anybody. And local reporters that we've commiserated with couldn't get anybody to talk to us. The local group sent us to the state office, which did not respond. The only information that we've been able to get has been from individual scientists who have been doing these tests. We just got a test that was released earlier this week, a scientific analysis of the airborne, how far airborne these particles are from the blue-green algae. And they found that it can get all the way into the alveoli of the lungs.
Wow.
And that came out just this week. But we're still not hearing anything or any warnings from the state. So it'll be interesting going forward if that ends up becoming something.
Mm-hmm. So you think about this. This is kind of like Florida's Flint water crisis. There are phenomenal health consequences that are occurring that the state, for political reasons, is it's certainly not good for if you're a politician whose job depends upon getting public support, letting people know that under your administration, under your lax administration, serious threats to the health. You know, in 20 years, people are going to develop liver cancers, and they're going to develop liver cancer probably coming from contact with the blue-green algae.
Yeah, these are toxins. We don't really even know how to deal with them.
Right.
It's not like you can take an antibiotic and get rid of it. Now, later on today on All Things Considered, we're going to have a story on by Andrea Perdomo talking about birds on Marco Island that are falling out of the sky, convulsing and dying, and they still don't know what's causing that. I mean, some suspect red tide, but it's not confirmed. Tissue samples have been sent to the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission before Thanksgiving, and those results are still not back. So we still don't know what's killing them. Meanwhile, people are still going on vacation and going out to the beach there. So we don't know what it is.
So, again, I just want to be careful. I mean, again,
I know,
we're not an
science.
Environmental group, not a scientific group. Our concern is that this is information that the people had a right to know, that the government of Florida did not provide them adequately.
That'll be, and we'll be following that one with your successor at the ACLU of Florida. I wanted to ask before we're almost out of time. Do you have any final thoughts that you'd like to share with us?
Well, there's a lot of work to be done. I mean, the drive for complete human rights in the world is never completed. I guess I have maybe two final thoughts. I never remember a time where I thought our democratic values are more precarious, not only here, but if you look at what's happening here, I mean, the Trump administration is taking a playbook out of what's happening all over Europe by scapegoating immigrants and using fear and scapegoating of immigrants and racial divisive language for political advantage. So this is a very, very precarious time for democratic values, and I hope people step up and defend our democracy. I'm going to go off into retirement. I still be an ACLU member and supporter, but I certainly am going to do whatever I can to try to preserve our democracy. There's a lot more work to be done even here in Florida. We are still in the middle of criminal justice reforms that are needed, and a smooth, effective landing for Amendment 4 is going to be very, very important, because I do think, I mean, we were in it for way more than a decade because we thought that adding 1.4 million people to the voting electorate in Florida will transform our state forever. And I hope it does, and I hope politicians don't get in the way of the wishes of the voters.
Well, I want to congratulate you on quite the career, and we hope to hear from you in the future as you go off into retirement. We want to continue to hold the megaphone for you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Howard Simon, he's the former executive director of the ACLU of Florida. He retired last week after serving 21 years at the helm here in our state and 44 years in all with the ACLU. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
When we return, a new federal climate report predicts significant economic and human harm in the near future, including increased rates of wildfires, flooding, seasonal allergies, red tide, harmful algal blooms, hurricane intensity, and agriculture yields. We're joined by a UF professor and a medical doctor to discuss the implications for us here in Southwest Florida. I'm Julie Glenn, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.